the idea of the Christian society in the Middle Ages, the Corpus Christianum. This first week we want to look at the government or the political history from the time of Charlemagne down to the time of Innocent III at the beginning of the 13th century. Next week we would look at the extent of this Christian society, and then 3 weeks from now look at the culture and especially the theology from this period of history. When we're talking about the Christian society in the Middle Ages, you're talking about two things, really. First of all, an ideal, and secondly, a reality. Sometimes when this is discussed, the Christian society, these two things are closely related. At other times, they are not. If we think of this Christian society as one that is highly organized, as, say, the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod, or even denominations that are more highly organized, more centralized than our denomination is, then we haven't gotten too close to the reality of it. Secondly, if we think of this Christian society as being one in which there were no divisions within it, and one that included all Christians in this period of history, we also have the wrong idea. In other words, when we're talking about the Christian society of the Middle Ages, we're talking about European society, West European society, not even Central Europe, and certainly not Eastern Europe. That is, Central Europe, by that I mean the satellite countries today, Bohemia and areas east. There is a great deal written today about Christian society as an age of faith, as distinct from the modern age of science. I suppose this is true, but this too can be misunderstood. To suggest that everyone in these centuries participated knowingly, willingly in this ideal of a Christian society. This is what we mean then, basically, by the first point to distinguish between the ideal and the reality. It's very important for us as Lutherans because it has often been suggested that Luther divided Christianity, the Christian society. And if we understand the nature and the limits and the content of this society, this kind of statement can be made in truth. But if we mean by that all Christians were one until Luther in the 16th century, and then he divided Christendom in half, this is hardly true. Therefore, the distinction is rather important. Now, we begin our discussion of Christian society with Charlemagne, because it is at this point. Well, actually, because the men, the historians, the theologians of the 10th century and of the 12th century looked back to Charlemagne, what happened in 800 AD as the foundation, as the beginning of this grand alliance of the papacy with the with a strong military authority in the West. You have all read now the coronation of Charlemagne, I assume, and we'll recall the quotation there from James Bryce, his grand study of the Holy Roman Empire, where he says the coronation of Charles is not only the central event of the Middle Ages, it is also one of those very few events of which, taking them singly, it may be said that if they had not happened, the history of the world would have been different. Whether we would agree to this or not, it is true that in the High Middle Ages, this is the way they understood this event, the period about which we are speaking. In 800, then, you have a Frank political ruler made emperor. Charlemagne had borne the title of patrician, a title similar similarly borne by earlier Germanic leaders like Alaric and Theodoric. What makes 800 important is not merely that you have such an alliance between church and a tribal leader. This had occurred long before 800, already in the 8th century. You recall we took that up earlier in the course, the efforts of the Gregory II and Gregory III, Stephen II, in dealing with Charlemagne's predecessors. What is important here is that Charlemagne takes the title not merely of patrician or of consul, of an ally, a subordinate ally of the emperor in Constantinople, but is called emperor. In other words, this is a claim, whether he meant it as such or not, that there is an authority in the West now equal to the political authority at Constantinople. Indeed, the great axis of Christian history shifts now from an east-west axis, that is, the relationships between Rome and Constantinople, to a north-south axis, the relationships between Rome and the Germanic peoples of Western and Central Europe. Secondly, in 800, Charlemagne is made emperor by Rome. He is crowned by Leo III. Now, whatever you say about it, whatever Leo III's motives were, whatever Charles's motives were, it's this thing that happened there on Christmas Day that is perhaps more important than attempting to filter out the motives. Charles had come to Italy to defend Leo. This had happened before, in the 70s already of the 8th century. Charles had never been, nothing like this had ever been happened in his previous efforts to protect the papacy from the encroachments of the Lombards and other tribes in Italy. Now, when Charlemagne comes south to defend Leo III, not only against the Lombards, but against the various factions in Italy at this time, who, for other than spiritual or theological reasons, didn't particularly like Leo III as their pope and wanted to get rid of him. This, of course, is why they would blind him and cut out his tongue, as he claimed. No man who was so maimed could canonically sit on the papal throne. They tried to do this to him. They were not, evidently, weren't successful, if they even tried it. In any case, coming down then to protect Leo III, Charlemagne is then given a crown. Now, from here on, I think we can leave the rest of the amplification of this particular event in 800 to your reading of Sullivan. I would hope, however, that you would pay particularly close attention to the poetic ideas, the ideals of the poets in the court of Charlemagne, of what happened here. I think these are very important and should be taken quite seriously. The attitude of Alcuin toward Charles, that he can think of Charlemagne as the modern David, and yet also refer to him at the same time by various Latin names from earlier Christian and pre-Christian history. The ideals of Einhard, the biographer of Charlemagne. The fact that the chroniclers of the time spoke of Charles as the 68th Roman emperor, succeeding Constantine, four or six, I don't remember which, in Constantinople. These things to me are extremely important. Now, whether these things were also in the mind of Charlemagne, or whether they came from the mind of Charlemagne to the minds of the poets, or the other way around, is a matter of some debate, as you know by now. But in any case, pay attention to these ideals, because it's here that you have in poetry the great ideals of the Christian Empire, just as the great ideals of the Pax Romana, the age of peace in early Rome, was actually a creation also of the Roman poets from the time of the Principate, and just as the idea that we will run across now in modern church history, Moscow, the Third Rome. Rome being the first, Constantinople the second, Moscow the third of the great Romes of the Christian world. Is another one of those poetic ideals with less substance in fact than is often imagined. So pay attention to this. I think that's important. Other than that, I think we'll leave it go. And if we want to talk about any of these items that you will be reading about in Sullivan, we can spend some time with them on Thursday and Friday. Now, B, however, is extremely important. The way Charlemagne and the way the Roman bishop viewed themselves as the focus, the focal point of this Christian society. Yes, here we are. First of all, when Leo III engages in this double talk, when he is being judged in 799 and 800, Charlemagne had come down to adjudge this problem that had arisen between Leo III and his critics, as you recall from Sullivan. And Leo III says, in order to hear this case, not to judge the case, only to hear it, the most clement and serene Lord King Charles, here present, has come to this city with his clergy and his lords. Therefore, I, Leo, Pontiff of the Holy Roman Church, without being judged or compelled by anyone, but by an act of spontaneous will, purify and purge myself in your presence. The implication being here, more than an implication, that the Bishop of Rome, the Pope, as we have learned to know him, can be judged by no one. This has been said before. It is repeated now by Leo III in the face of the efforts of King Charles to adjudicate a difficult situation in Rome. It has perhaps little substance in fact, but it gives you an impression of the way that Leo thought of himself, the role that he was to play in this society, in this alliance between Rome and the Franks. Secondly, Leo looked upon the Franks as protectors. Charlemagne was his defender, his advocate. No more. Perhaps Leo thinks about the papacy pretty much the way Isidore of Seville talked about it. The quotation from Isidore is in Solomon. Thirdly, we have to remember here, of course, the donation of Constantine, in which the jurisdiction of Christian society in the West is given primarily to the Bishop of Rome. Very important. At this time, of course, this document is an extremely important document. Now, do some reading here on your own beyond this. Get this whole problem clear in your mind, because it's the one that dominates the political history of the Middle Ages. Who is the actual ruler of this Christian society? This is the way the Bishop of Rome looked upon his role compared to that of the strongest political force of his time, that individual with whom he was allied in this Christian society. This is the way many representatives of the papacy will think of their particular role in this society. However, this must be compared with Charles's view, which is clearly not the same. If in some way the tension, the ambiguities, the ambivalence between these two views had been worked out already at this time, there was probably not even any consciousness of it in the ninth century, at least not in the form that we are talking about it here. But if it had been worked out, then a great deal of the political history of the Middle Ages would, of course, have been vastly different. The conflicts between papacy and empire, or the conflict, if you see this all as one, a great conflict, would perhaps have been avoided. But the basic point is that Charles's view is different, distinct from that of the various popes, but especially that of Leo III. Again, as you, in the various books that you are studying, look at the role that the papacy plays in this Christian society, note these things carefully. And then also, as you read some good study, of Charles's role in the church. Note this also, the view of his role vis-a-vis that of the Roman bishop. This quotation from Charles, it's from page 29 of your study on the coronation of Charlemagne, a letter from Charles, probably written by Alcuin, to Leo III, already in 795, when Leo III became pope. He says, "I desire to establish with your blessedness an inviolable pact of faith and of charity, by the grace of which apostolic blessing might follow me everywhere, and the most holy see of the Roman Church might constantly defend." This is the role that the Roman bishop was to play as far as Charlemagne was concerned. He was to be a defender of the faith. Furthermore, "It pertains to me," Charlemagne says, "with the aid of divine piety, to defend in all places the Holy Church of Christ by force of all arms." This is my job. "From outside, against the incursions of the pagans and the devastations of the infidels, internally protecting it by the diffusion of the Catholic faith. To you, most Holy Father, it pertains, elevating your mind toward God with Moses, to aid us by your prayers for the success of our arms." So whereas the Bishop of Rome thinks of himself as the focal point in this Christian society, with the emperor, the leader of the Franks, as his protector, as his defender militarily, his advocate, and no more than that. Charlemagne, on the other hand, thinks of himself as the focal point in the government of this Christian society, and the Bishop of Rome is something like his chaplain. He's his spiritual advisor. He prays, "Let your prudence be attached at all points to the prescriptions of the canons, and follow constantly the rules established by the Holy Fathers." Hadrian had given Charlemagne a book of these canons, you recall, when he had visited Italy previously. Charlemagne, having looked at them at least, tells Leo that he thinks he ought to live by these canons. These canons will, of course, by the time of Gregory the Seventh, become extremely important in the conflict between papacy and empire, in a way that I'm sure Charlemagne himself never dreamed. "So that," he goes on, "your life may in every way give the example of holiness." This is the other obligation of the Roman bishop, to be an example of holiness. Roman bishops in the 9th and 10th centuries generally were not examples of holiness. This is universally admitted. "Let only pious exhortations come forth from your mouth, and let your light shine before all men." Now Charlemagne then says that it is the king's business to defend with arms, to maintain the faith, to maintain the faith, the Holy Father should be no more than a pattern of righteousness, a chaplain, a man who, like Moses, raises up his arms in petition to the Heavenly Father. This is the ambiguity, the ambivalence between the two views, and becomes historically then the basis for the fact that in this Christian society of the Middle Ages, you have two foci in its government, the church and the state. And they never agree, actually, as to how they dispose of themselves over against each other. Now, I'd like to turn immediately to part three here. Charles's view of the empire, I think you can get that too, pretty much, from Sullivan. Charles's role in ecclesiastical affairs. Here he demonstrates clearly how he feels about his role in this Christian society. Very clear. First of all, Charles's role in ecclesiastical affairs is closely related to the larger program that he undertook of reform in the educational areas. Charles, we will be talking about the civil here, at least as it relates to the church under C. But there are a great many ways in which Charles attempted to bring the dukes, for example. This is not important for church history, but it is to see the larger context of Charles's relationship to the church, or to the priests and the bishops and the papacy. Attempted to bring the dukes, the traditional rulers of the various groupings that he conquers. There is hardly a year that Charles is not on the battlefield. I believe one of the, according to Thompson and Johnson, one of the chroniclers suggests that there was one year that he didn't go out to fight. He was constantly defending expanding and defending the frontiers of the empire. The Spanish March, as it's called, the Spanish March, the famous Chanson de Roland that you probably have read somewhere in your world literature studies, humanities or something like that, the Song of Rome. Then against the Lombards here in Italy, this is pretty much the limits of his empire here, and then over here in Italy also. He never captures all of it, but only goes down about halfway. Then this western end of the Danube and the Oder River over here, limiting his empire. This is where modern Bohemia is, or Czechoslovakia. Fighting in that area, and then up here, this is the area of the Saxons, immediately south of Denmark. Then his capital was over here at Aix-la-Chapelle, or Aachen, just off the Rhine River. That is, his capital moved about from place to place. But the point that I want to make is that in all of these areas, all of the fringes of his empire, this is where he constantly spent time, every year of his reign. They only fought, you see, for certain months of the year. You went out in the spring, you conscripted your army in early spring, you went out and fought your campaigns, and then you came home. This was not what we today would call total war. Then when these areas were, Charlemagne is constantly integrating them, these newly captured areas into the empire. And this requires a great deal of civil reform, replacing the dukes with counts who were his appointees, and then keeping tab on the counts via the bishops whom he usually appointed as his missi, men who were to report directly to him. The counts were sort of the judges and the magistrates who were tied down to a given area. Whereas he moved the missi about from place to place each year so that no alliance could be made between this one representative of Charlemagne with the other representative, and that way he felt he could keep some tab on these political leaders. Well, in any case, this is the kind of thing I'm talking about. A great deal of effort at bringing some kind of conformity and loyalty throughout this Frankish empire. And then also, as I've already indicated earlier, in the area of education. Charlemagne carries out a great many reforms in Bettensen. I don't have the page listed here, but this one capitulary that he sent out dealing with education, you should note it here. I'll give you the page tomorrow. Where he tells about this, how he wants a school for children in every village, and this should be part of the function of the parish priest. And then his own court, his own palace school, became, as it were, a symbol of what should be done in every county of a Frankish society. So these reforms are very important. I have another translation of this capitulary here, but it isn't the one from Bettensen, so I don't have the page number. Now, related to these reforms, you have Charlemagne legislating in almost every area of ecclesiastical life, both theological and administrative. Charlemagne enjoyed reading Augustine's City of God and evidently saw his relationship to the church in much the same way that Augustine, both in the City of God as Charlemagne understood it, and as Augustine saw the role of Honorius, in Augustine's letters, and that is that the state plays an extremely, there's only one society. There are perhaps two foci in this society, but the dominant foci is that of the Roman Emperor, in Augustine's case, Honorius, in Charlemagne's case, himself, and it is his duty, as Augustine clearly says, of making sure that things are done properly, as we would say, decently and in order, throughout the empire. And Charlemagne evidently took this quite seriously. He legislates in every possible area of ecclesiastical life. There are very good discussions of this, I think, in Laterette or in Walker, if you read the sections in these volumes on this. A number of examples. Charlemagne, for example, makes Gregorian chant the form of liturgical music in the Western Empire. Whether it is Gregorian or not, that is, whether it is from Gregory or not, this was a reform to bring all of the music of the Mass into some kind of conformity. This was associated with his educational reforms because it was in teaching the quadrivium, the quadrivium of which music is a part, that he taught the young men in the various counties of his empire to sing Gregorian chant as part of the worship life. Secondly, he legislated that all parish priests were to preach and teach their subjects, their members, the Creed, the Lord's Prayer, and the Ten Commandments. This was to be learned by all. It's out of this, of course, that Luther's accent on the three chief parts ultimately comes. The basis of the catechism and the catechetical method. Then thirdly, he reforms the monasteries in the Frankish Empire. This through Benedict of Anian, or Aniani, A-N-I-A-N-E. Benedict becomes far more important during the period of Louis the Pious. Benedict of Anian.
Yes, sir.
There's nothing on anyway. No, I don't think there's any more here that'll help you. This is all part of B here. Legislates in many ecclesiastical areas. The first one then under B is Gregorian chants. The second one is the first three chief parts, as we would speak of it. The third one is the reform of the Benedictine houses in Frankland, which includes the areas to the extent of this map diagram that I showed you. Benedict of Anian helped him carry this out. What it was is to require all of the monasteries, the Benedictine houses in Frankland, to follow an authentic copy of Benedict's rule. These had been messed up in Frankland, especially with copying. Fourthly, the Apostles' Creed becomes the dominant creed now all through Western Christianity. Perhaps this is based on the Roman symbol from the 3rd and 4th century, perhaps not. But in any case, the examples that we have from of the Apostles' Creed, the first texts that we have of our Apostles' Creed, come from South France, Southern Gaul, in the 5th century. It was evidently a creed that was used primarily in this area of Aquitaine and Languedoc, as it is known throughout the greater share of medieval history. We have examples, exact examples, of the Apostles' Creed as we know it today from the 8th century, which I think is interesting, from Gaul. Charlemagne's role is to require a uniformity also here, as in the area of Gregorian chant, as in the observance of an authentic Benedictine rule, as in the teaching of catechumens and the preaching of the church. So here, the creed that is confessed is to be the apostolic symbol, as it was known. Fifthly, he causes more accurate copies of the Vulgate, of this Holy Scripture itself, the Latin Scripture, Jerome's Latin, to come into existence. This is emphasized, that the various corruptions of the Vulgate that had been common in Gaul were now changed to more authentic copies. Sixthly, he has Paul the Deacon write a honorarian, the counterpart of the Concordia pulpit, so that every pastor, every priest in Frankland would have a sermon for especially the festival days of the church year. And these sermons, interestingly enough, by the way, are in the vernacular. This, I think, is important. We will talk about this again, but this is very important when you talk about the relationship of preaching in the period of the Lutheran Reformation to preaching in the Middle Ages. This illustrates very clearly, it seems to me, Charles's interpretation of his role in the life of the church. None of these reforms are what we would call clearly theological matters is undertaken with any consultation with the Roman bishop. He doesn't see that this is necessary. Charles does this in consultation with his own, with the bishops of Frankland. But he is the leader. And he assumes, of course, that the Bishop of Rome is praying for the success of his efforts. He reforms not only then in theological areas, but also in strict
strictly ecclesiastical matters, the political life of the church, the life of the parish priest.
I have outlined it in this way, that what you have during this period is specifically the feudal church. Now, we don't have time here to talk about feudalism, much less the feudal church. We just have to take up certain basic items here to get some idea of what Charlemagne did. If you're interested in studying feudalism, I would suggest highly the two chapters on it in Thompson and Johnson, or the very fine book on the subject by Sidney Painter, P-A-I-N-T-E-R, which is part of this Cornell series. If you are interested in looking at getting a good insight into the feudal church, the structure of the feudal church, I would suggest the study by Baldwin that is in your syllabus. It gives you the best analysis of medieval feudal ecclesiology than any other book that I know. But the point being primarily that what you have now is the church structured feudally. The ecclesiastical structure of the church is feudal, rather than independent, for example, independently as it was prior to the time of Constantine, or administratively centralized as it will become in 18th century Prussia and so forth. In the Middle Ages, it's a feudal structure, because the social patterns of the Middle Ages were feudal. You'll have to, if you don't know what this means, you'll have to find that out on your own. But it is a good area for study. What we're concerned to show now is how the structure of the medieval church, of this Christian society in the period after Charlemagne, is related to this overall social and economic feudalism. Essentially, what it means is in these three subdivisions under C there, the churches were by and large all the territory of the churches, the property, the land of the priests and so forth, was under the feudal ownership. Ownership in the Middle Ages is always feudal. Was under the feudal ownership of a lay lord, and that included the church property, the parish priest at the time of Charlemagne was usually a vassal, as were the bishops of the secular lord. He had the final control over the life of the church in his area. Perhaps the best way to get an insight into this would be to read some of the English novels from the 18th and 19th centuries. Anthony Trollope's novels, for example, or The Vicar of Wakefield. Novels like that, they're interesting to read, and they do give you a picture of this kind of society, which of course is a very different structure for the church's very different social structure of the church than we know today. B, this results in the dual character of the clergy. A clergyman, a priest, and a bishop in feudal society is not only a spiritual functionary, he is also a political functionary. And finally, this comes out then in the controversy over investiture. That is, who makes a priest a priest? The bishop or his feudal, his political superior? Now, what I would like to do then is to look at the life of a parish priest and then the life of a bishop in this period, and in the area, the empire of Charlemagne, to give you some idea of what we mean when we, to spell this out a little bit, the idea of the Lord's control and of the dual character of the priest. First of all, then, the parish priest. This material is taken, 80% of it at least, from Bulwin's Medieval Church, the book that I recommend for your reading. Just a few highlights from it to point up this feudal relationship. The parish at this time, in Charlemagne's time, and in the years following, comes to mean a geographical area that is served by a priest. There's only one church, of course, at this time, in Frankland generally. You don't have a denominational structure, so when you speak of a parish in the Middle Ages, you are speaking of a geographical area that is served by a priest. The area of a bishop made up of various parishes is, of course, called a bishopric. In the ancient church, you recall, the area served by a bishop was the parish. That shifts now as the church's structure becomes more full. A parish that was served by a priest was, secondly, usually owned by one man. And all of the individuals living within his parish were subject, were vassals, or laborers of this one lord. In other words, the whole area was owned feudally by one individual. These individuals then worked the land. Society in the Frankish Empire was agricultural by and large. But one area, one square, as we would say, or 140, was under the control of the priest. It was the area on which his church building stood, his chapel, or his church, and it was the area that he farmed also. By and large, parish priests in Franklin were serfs, or out of that tradition. They were not out of the nobility. They were children of farmers, and most of them continued to farm. Or they, in turn, enfeudated this land to others, so that an individual, so that the priest, in turn, became the feudal lord of another individual who was working his land as a vassal. Now, the duties of a parish priest in Franklin were primarily to baptize, to hear confession, confession, and to assign penance. We will continue there tomorrow. May I see Mr. Rosenketter? Is he here? Please.